welcome back. I think we're all back now. So I'm going to kick off this seminar starting tonight. And well, we call it a seminar. I always think that sounds a bit grandiose for what it is. Basically, I'll talk for a bit, and if you're lucky, I might stop talking and let you have a chance to talk. But hopefully, I will not get too carried away, and I'll leave space for you to ask questions or reflect on what I'm saying. So I've written up on the flip chart, I hope everybody can just about seeing it, a very, very important word or couple of words, and that is praticcit samuppada. And a rough translation of this is something like conditioned co-production or conditioned arising. So this was the core insight of the Buddha. When we say that the Buddha became enlightened, one way we could say that is that this is what the Buddha saw. The Buddha saw that everything, absolutely everything, arises out of a complex set of conditions and will pass away when those conditions cease to be. And not only does everything arise out of this complex of conditions, everything will be part of the conditions on which future phenomena arise. So nothing's fortuitous, nothing sort of accidental, as it were. And absolutely nothing is fixed and unchanging. That was why I got us to do that little exercise in the meditation, or that little reflection of just noticing the changingness of the breath. It might have sounded quite a simple, even obvious thing to do, but what we're trying to realise, sort of deeply realise, is that there's absolutely nothing that's fixed and unchanging. Yeah, absolutely nothing. And you can see this, of course, in the material world. For example, a seed is just one stage on the way to a plant, which is just one stage on the way to a seed, as it were. And actually, you know, if you even pay a little tiny bit of attention to that, you can see that this thing we call seed and this thing that we call plant and then this thing that we call seed again aren't so fixed as even those words. Like, when does the seed become the plant? Is it when it first, you know, is it when the first shoot pokes out, or is it when you first see that little bit of green in the seed? You know, if you've got an orange seed or something, you can sometimes see that little bit of green. Or is it when the first leaf appears? You know, actually, when is it? When can you say, oh, now it's a seed, now it's a plant, now it's a seed again? Do you see what I mean? That actually there's no it becoming something else. All that is changingness. All there is changingness. There's no, you know, a leaf changes from, like, you know, like the spring leaves, the little crinkly pale green, then the summer leaves fully open, we'll have the autumn leaves red or yellow. But actually, where's the leaf in a way and all that? All there is change. All there is a process of change. If we look closely at the physical world, we can see that. But this is not just scientific, yeah? It includes that, but it includes much more than that, because the Buddha saw that our mind itself arises out of a complex set of conditions, and all the mind is changing. When I say the mind, I mean, don't just mean our brain, I mean in a way, our whole well, sense of ourself, our volitions, our moods, and so on, that there's just this complex changingness, yeah? So it's not just scientific, although it includes that. There's the mind as well, and actually more than the mind, or more than the mind as we usually know it. All is included in this great law of praticca samuppada, conditioned co-production. And that's the, as I say, the core insight of the Buddha. Now, even saying that sort of falsifies it a bit, because the Buddha, the experience the Buddha had on the night of his enlightenment was completely wordless and conceptless, because it was beyond that. And then, as it were, the Buddha, when he decided to teach, had to almost come down a few notches, as it were, to put his experience into words to try and communicate it, yeah? And this was, this law of praticca samuppada, the Buddha trying to put into words an experience that's completely beyond words, literally beyond words, yeah? But if you could put it into words, these are the words you put it into. Praticca samuppada, conditioned co-production, changingness, yeah, all there is change. There's actually no fixed things behind that change. If you look even a little bit closer, and I'd encourage you to do that when you do the mindfulness of breathing, see, almost it's like almost like you're seeing, can you find anything unchanging? Can you find an it? And you won't be able to find an it that changes, whether that's the breath or the sounds you hear. But the looking is important, because the looking helps you to realise the truth of that changingness more deeply. Okay, so that's the first great thing. So the second great thing, and this will be familiar to those of you who have been coming along, that there's two modes or trends in which this changingness happens. And they are what you might call the cyclic trend and the spiral trend, yeah? And in a way, they're quite good descriptive words. So change can happen sort of on a level, as it were. Change can happen can just in the sense of going round and round in a circle. Habits, as somebody said, same things happening over and over again. You know, you're happy for a little bit, but then you're upset, and then you get happy again, da-da-da, but it just keeps going round and round. Change can happen in a spiral, a responsive, and again, somebody used that word, a responsive rather than reactive mode, yeah? So the characteristics, I'll just say some of the characteristics to show the difference between these two modes, and we're particularly this evening going to be concentrating on the spiral. If you've been coming to classes previously, we've been looking a lot at the cyclic mode, so we're going to be more tonight looking at the spiral. So this cyclic mode is reactive, whereas the spiral is creative. Yeah? The cyclic mode's in one dimension. If you think of something like, this. So the cyclic mode is, you know, just literally going round and round in one dimension. If you can imagine a sort of spiral, then you've immediately got more dimensions coming into play, and this will be important, as we'll see later. Cyclic is repetitive, so you're just going round and over and over and over the same territory. As a matter of fact, you're not just going over it. If you imagine that this is actually a wheel, then you're digging the ruts of your habits deeper, you know. So every time you act habitually, you increase the propensity to do that again, yeah? So the cyclic mode is repetitive, whereas the spiral is generative all the time, and the spiral more, something new is coming into being. Sangharajita Bhante has got a lovely aphorism he uses. He says, the creative mind, that's a mind in spiral mode, loves where there's no reason to love, is generous where there's no reason to be generous, forgives where there's no reason to forgive. So that's what I mean by generative. It brings more into the world, yeah? Whereas the reactive's just like, you know, I'm not going to forgive you till you forgive me. You know, it's the sort of exchange, you know, it's just going round and round. The cyclic mode is, it's isolated, the cyclic mode, because it's kind of what you're circling round, and me in the middle of everything. So you're isolating yourself, it's cut off from the rest of humanity. Again, you could see it as maybe not just going round and round, but actually getting tighter and tighter, like a knot that's getting tighter and tighter, to use another image. So it's isolated, whereas the spiral mode is connected. This spiral is more and more connected with other people because it's less and less egocentric. And when you're in the spiral mode, you sort of positively forget to be a me. You know, when you just, find the best birthday present for someone that you know they've really been looking for and wishing for, in that moment you sort of forget to be a me and what's in it for me. So it's a positive self-forgetting. You just feel so happy, you know, because you know you're going to make the other person pleased. You're imagining their happiness. So it's connected. The cyclic mode is limited because you're just like stuck on this wheel. The spiral is unlimited, like you were saying earlier. To use the Buddhist terms, this cyclic mode is samsara or samsaric. Samsara means acting out of this mode. We sort of samsarize, yeah? We limit ourselves, so that's what samsara is, whereas the spiral is nirvanic. We nirvanize, yeah? We move towards nirvana or enlightenment, yeah? So that's just a little sort of whiz through, but very important whiz through these sort of different modes. So do people, from these different ways I've described it, do you sort of get a sense, yeah? And some of you will be familiar with this, but it's good to go over it. Okay, so basically what sort of drives us round and round on that wheel, on that cyclic mode, is craving and hatred. It's delusion as well, but I'll come back to that. So what drives us round on the wheel is, we're human beings, we all have experience all the time. Just by nature of having a human body and a human mind, we all have experience all the time. And often that is painful, or maybe if it's not acutely painful, it's we all have times, maybe very often, where we just don't feel satisfied. Yeah, we just don't. So we might feel bored, like Jnanavajra in his jacuzzi. We might just feel a sort of dis-ease with ourselves. Yeah. And then what we usually do when we're not aware is we respond to that by craving. We try and do something to make ourselves less bored or less whatever, yeah? We try and pull something into ourselves, or by hatred, i.e. we try and push the thing that we think is causing our suffering away, yeah? So we do this pull-push thing. But all that does, if we do that in an unaware way, is drive us around that wheel, yeah? So that's our usual mode. But what Buddhism is trying to teach us is that there is something different we can do. There is something different we can do. We can act in this creative way, and then we'll get off this wheel, as it were, onto this spiral path. The spiral is connected to the wheel in a very important way, which I'll come back to in a moment. So what we're going to explore tonight is the nature of this spiral, the spiral path. How do we get off the wheel and onto the spiral? How do we stay on the spiral once we're on it, and not just sort of fall back down, as it were, onto the wheel? And where's freedom? Where does freedom come into it, as we've been talking about, yeah? Okay, so just got another diagram on this spiral here. That's the thank you to Matt for drawing this spiral. Harder to draw a spiral, I think. I was trying to invent a sort of really need a three-dimensional model or something. So maybe there's a few important things to say about this spiral. So basically, it starts here, and almost you can imagine. Maybe that's something I managed to draw this, so mess up the draw. But if you can imagine this as the wheel, yeah, in one dimension, going round and round. The spiral sort of comes off the wheel and starts going up and up, yeah? And you can see this thing about the dimensions, can't you? That it's, well, you can't really, you can imagine it in three dimensions, but can you see it's also going outwards, so that's more and more connected with other people. And also it's gone more and more upwards, and also, what's really important is it hasn't got a limit. It's only limited because that was the size of the paper, if you see what I mean. You could keep on drawing, you could keep on going up that spiral, as it were. Yeah. So even enlightenment isn't the end point. So you could say that enlightenment is just the furthest point on the horizon of that spiral that we can see from where we stand, yeah? Even enlightenment isn't the end point. That's really, really important. But in a way, that spiral just keeps going on and on in this unlimited, unbounded way, yeah? But if, let's just have a little tiny little game just now. So let's, even though, so enlightenment isn't the end point, but say enlightenment is here, it's given that we've come off the page. So say that's enlightenment, yeah? Up there. And this spiral is ever increasing positivity, yeah? Where it's like I need to give you all a pen, maybe like the tail on the donkey. Where's freedom? Yeah, so basically this is us on the wheel, yeah? This is enlightenment. Freedom is somewhere between there and enlightenment. So where would you put it?
At the point where the cycle.
So sort of here.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so let's have a anyone else? We'll collect a few. Anyone else wanna put it anywhere else?
Maybe a couple of spirals up when you've really conquered those habits.
Okay, so maybe a couple up when you've conquered the habits. So where about here?
Yeah.
So when you've really, could I have a script? Could you write Conquered the Habits? Because that's important, yeah.
Just beginning.
Oh yeah, so just here, so you would vote for here as well?
Yeah.
Roughly here, okay, so just begin freedom, yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
Do you have a kind of freedom axis going through the bottom to the top?
Yeah.
You're a bit free at the bottom, you get more and more and more free.
So when are you like really free?
I don't think you can answer that question. You don't know how free the Buddha really was.
Okay. Do you think the Buddha was free?
Yeah.
So do you think you could be enlightenment?
Maybe it's enlightenment. Maybe it's full enlightenment.
Full enlightenment.
Okay, you've got the answer.
Okay.
Would it be anywhere where it's going upwards and outwards?
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's all going upward and outward.
So as long as it's going upwards and outwards, that's freedom.
Yeah. So in a way. Yeah. That I think you're right. So that ties in with the axis. Yeah. Okay, so should I tell you what the tradition says?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, the tradition says here. that's what the Pali Canon says. So, in other words, so the tradition, so absolutely, so I think people have said there's a certain freedom here are not wrong, because you have to have some freedom to get off that wheel. But complete freedom is just before enlightenment. Enlightenment is actually beyond freedom. So what could be beyond freedom? Beyond freedom is knowing that you're free. So, and that's what we're going to hear a bit more about in week three of this course, yeah? So in week three, Padmavadra is going to come as a guest speaker. And Padmavadra was at this lecture, The Taste of Freedom, way back in the 70s. And he's going to talk about what freedom really is. Next week, Surya Gupta is going to be talking about something that's a surprise, not to her, but to you, an image of freedom. Yeah, but they just leave you there. So that is where complete freedom is, right up there, actually. And tonight we're going to start to explore, well, what are all the stages, yeah, to get there? Okay, so okay. So, but I think, as I say, I think the people that talked about freedom being here, that actually isn't wrong, because there's a certain freedom that must be in place to even realise you can get off this wheel at all and start to move. And how we do that, in a way, it's quite simple. It's really simple, but it's really hard to remember. And only hard to do because of one's own resistance. And how we get off the wheel depends on how we respond to that unsatisfactoriness, yeah? Unsatisfactory ranges from like real extreme pain and suffering down to just like a bit bored and a bit sort of antsy, a bit sort of itchy, yeah? Is how we respond to that. If we respond by hatred, pushing it away, or craving, we just stay on that wheel. If we manage to respond differently with awareness, we take the first step off that wheel and onto the spiral. And how you do this is through awareness. And the first step is, it's like not reacting, basically, which requires a bit of effort. So I'll give you a very simple example from my own experience. So I was on a 9-day retreat and I was coming back yesterday, and it was quite a longish journey because it was Sunday, and the first bit of the journey was a bus replacement service for the train. So that was a bit like, slightly bothersome, you know, having to, you know, felt like travel sick on the bus. It took about 3 times longer. So that was the first bit. And then the second bit was the train. The train was really, really packed. But anyway, I had bought this. I had bought the Sunday newspaper before I got on the train. Funny thing about those Sunday newspapers, I always think it's going to be a treat, and then it never is. I was looking at it, and I was going, like, this is actually wrong. And there's all these magazines falling out. You think, oh, there must be, you know, even, you know, anyway, even the recipe I don't like. You know, I was trying to get some enjoyment out of this, the newspaper. Looked all through the newspaper, couldn't be bothered with it. Okay, then the carriage got a bit quieter, so that was fine. Got a train, got to Paddington, underground to Bethnal Green. I was fed up with this paper, so I just threw it away on the train. Then I was on the underground, and I thought, oh no, I shouldn't have thrown the newspaper away. And I'm on the underground, I haven't got the paper. Even though the paper was rubbish, you know, I still wanted it. So I thought, why didn't I keep the paper? What am I going to read? What am I going to do on this journey? Just back off retreat. You think I'd be in a more positive state. But anyway, I was but then I must have been in a tiny bit of a positive state because I thought, this is it's a bit dramatic. You could just stay with the experience. Just stay with it. You haven't even got a paper. So rather than hankering after this paper, newspaper that I never had that was actually rubbish anyway, rather than looking at my phone or anything, I thought, just try and sit here and just experience what you are experiencing. And at first, it was a bit difficult. It was a bit of a sort of discipline, because I was a bit like, oh, I wish I had something to do. You know, I can't, you know, got a whole, like, 40 minutes on this underground. But actually, I did try, and what I noticed was, as I practiced, just sit on the chair, just relax. It did change. My experience did change. And what I particularly noticed was, I just started noticing other people, and I just started noticing them with just interest and sort of fondness. You know, I just felt not in a huge dramatic way, but I just thought, look at her. Oh, she's like about to have a baby. Or look at, oh, they're going to have a really interesting conversation. I wonder what that group of people are. Oh, it's like a mother, a father, and a son, and a new girlfriend, maybe. You know, just that was interesting. So it was kind of just, it just became very interesting, forever. It just became pleasant, yeah. But there definitely was a bit of, it started as a discipline, but then it just opened up. And that's quite nice, just sitting here, like taking an interest in people and feeling quite connected. And so I think that was an example of a little bit of freedom there. You know, a little bit of that initial freedom of stepping off the wheel, onto the spiral. Yeah, and do people sort of recognise that? Yeah. But it definitely took a bit of effort, because I wanted to just, have something, or, you know, to make this uncomfortable feeling going away. But sort of facing into the uncomfortable feeling, something new opened out. That's exactly what it felt like, something opening out. And I thought I could just have sat on that train. You know, obviously I did get off at my stop. But, you know, I could have happily sat on it for longer then. So the crucial thing is how we respond to unsatisfactoriness. The Buddhist word, of course, is dukkha, for unsatisfactory. How do we respond to that? So traditionally, we're told that this spiral path consists of 12 links. The Buddhist word is nidana, 12 links. Of course, it's not literally 12. It's not that our life's literally broken up into segments. But it can be helpful thinking of 12 links. And the first link of the spiral path is dukkha. So it's interesting that it's dukkha, and possibly a little surprising, but it's dukkha because the wheel and the spiral are joined. The spiral doesn't just sort of, it's not just free floating, it's connected with our actual life. So So the first thing is dukkha, because it's how we respond to dukkha that starts as ofya. The second link is shraddha. So shraddha in Buddhism means faith, but it's not faith in the blind belief sort of sense that we might be used to in our sort of post-Christian sort of era. Shraddha means something like, in its early stages, something like just opening to another possibility. That little glimmer that I managed to grasp of, like, there could be another way of doing this a bit or better. Let's just try it, you know. So that's the beginning of shraddha. There could be a new possibility. Literally, shraddha means a lifting up of the heart. So that's lovely, isn't it? It's a lifting up of the heart. It's like you see something's possible. When we're in touch with shraddha, it means we start to see a purpose in life. We see that life's for something, or could be for something. Again, a bit like Yanavacha was saying in the announcement, the jacuzzi actually wasn't that satisfying. Like the fact he was going to support a friend in a funeral, you know. There's my life's for something. I can make a contribution. It's for something. So the more you're in touch with shraddha, the more you see that more is possible than just going round and round on that wheel. And you want to move towards that. So you practice, yeah? So on that underground, I did have to practice. It didn't come naturally at first. I had to make a bit of an effort. I had to almost give myself a little talk until I say, look, come on, Sabetra Matthew. Like, try and, you know, like, you know, practice what you preach, as it were. This is your chance to actually do some of this stuff, yeah? So you see that more is possible, you want to move towards that, and you practice, yeah? Particularly as Buddhas, we practice the five precepts that we chant at the beginning. We practice trying to be more kind, more generous, more content, speak more truthfully, and be more mindful. As shraddha strengthens, you become a little less self-centered. Again, you can see that. Shraddha's probably, you know, if it's the next link, it's, you know, about here or something. You start to just open out your life more. And because you are being less self-centered and more kind, and less unkind, and more generous, and less selfish, more truthful, less untruthful. Another sort of magical thing happens is you start to experience the joy of a clear conscience. Yeah? You start to experience the joy of a clear conscience, which is a feeling to be treasured, I think. I more and more value that joy of a clear conscience. It's a different type of happiness than ordinary happiness. Just as the converse is true, the remorse of having acted unskillfully is the worst pain, I think. It's more painful than ordinary pain. I think ordinary pain's sort of bearable in a way, as long if you have a clear conscience, yeah? So it means the joy of a clear conscience, nothing's kind of bothering you in that particular way. So that's the next stage of the spiral path, is joy, yeah? So you've got dukkha to shraddha, or faith, and then there's joy. That opens into joy, and the joy is particularly this joy of a clear conscience. And then the joy sort of gives way, as it were. Each one of these on the spiral kind of unfolds into the next one, into rapture, which is like joy multiplied in a way. So then you have rapture. And then And that's usually described in terms of, like, you know, a physical rapture. You just, you know, you feel, just a rapture of sense. Then the next stage, interestingly, is calm, and then bliss, yeah? So you've got joy, rapture, calm, and bliss, which I always think it'd be amazing to even be able to distinguish between, you know, to sort of know the difference between those things. So joy, rapture, calm, bliss. The seventh stage is samadhi, yeah? So you might remember at the beginning of the class I talked about samadhi is this energized calm. So there you've got it all together, this calm that's energized, yeah? So joy, rapture, calm, and bliss have given way, as it were, given rise to samadhi. So I think it is interesting that samadhi proper, we have glimpses of samadhi in meditation, but samadhi proper, as it were, only happens at the seventh stage. Which I think shows us that to really meditate, we have to do quite a lot of preparation. Bhante said, actually, if your whole life can become a preparation for meditation, and if you do that, if you make your life a preparation for meditation, when you sit up on the cushion, you'll already be meditating. You won't have to make any effort. And particularly, in this context, I think this clear conscience dimension is very important for meditation. That's why we talk about practicing the precepts as a foundation for meditation. That's why we chant the precepts before we meditate. Very, very difficult to meditate if we've got something troubling our conscience. Actually, impossible, really. I think maybe putting it another way around, I was going to give a little bit of a health warning to meditation. If you have got something on your conscience, meditation won't sort of let you get away with it, as it were. I had a very, very strong experience of this when I first started to meditate at this centre here. 30 plus years ago, I was, you know, I'd come along, I'd like the class, I'd like the teachers, I was starting to practice meditation at home, and as I started to meditate a bit more, every time I tried to meditate, I started to feel really nauseous, and I thought, gosh, you know, what's happening, what am I doing wrong? So I went to the person teaching meditation and I said, oh, you know, that's funny things happen. And every time I sit down to meditate, I just like feel really sick. I just feel really weird. Like, what am I doing wrong? And what I thought they were going to do is give me some sort of meditation instruction about, I don't know, how to sit a different way or something like that. And they said, what's going on in the rest of your life? Strange question to ask me. Why on earth does she ask me that? And I said, oh, that's a strange question. She said, no, well, it might be good to, you know, what you ask me again, what's going on in the rest of your life? And then I said, well, actually, I'm not going to tell you what I said because I'm too embarrassed, but anyway, it wasn't great, but what's going on the rest of my life? And did involve not keeping quite a few of the precepts. I suddenly realised, oh, that's what it is, you know. I can't, if I'm like, you know, involved in, well, a bit of a sort of web of deceit, basically, was what I was involved in, and that I thought I could get away with, as long as, you know, it's that kind of what people don't know won't hurt them sort of scenario that I'd convinced myself was all right. And like, meditation just wouldn't let me keep that up. Do you see what I mean? I couldn't keep up that. I had to sort that out to meditate. So in a way, her question was exactly right to me. I had to go back, as it were, to those earlier stages and really look at my ethics and sort all that out. It's not that I stopped meditating, I kept on meditating, but simultaneously, like, you know, got all that sorted out, that sort of mess. And then I realised, oh yeah, this is entirely important. And this is why, in a way, that samadhi or meditation proper is actually quite right up at the seventh stage, right up about, I don't know, right up here. It's not that you've got to wait till you get everything sorted, until you try and meditate. Just try and meditate anyway. But to the extent that you haven't sort of worked in the preparation, and, you know, by preparation, I don't just mean like getting the right cushions or so on. I mean really looking at your life. Then you won't. Meditation proper, this complete state of energized calmness, you know, the state of mind of the Buddha, won't come into being. Yeah. So maybe just pause there. Should I just pause there for a moment? Does that, what I said about ethics and meditation particularly, does that make sense to people? Yeah. Does that sort of ring true in your experience? Yes. Yeah.
I think it would make more sense to me if I knew what exactly you were unraveling.
Okay. Well, it was just telling lies to people, really. Yeah. It's just behavior that involves sort of deceit. Yeah. So I thought I could do that, be involved in this kind of sort of deceitful model, and happily meditate. Yeah. So I had to go back on, you know, sort of sort that out, yeah? Does that make sense? Yeah? Yeah. That was what, but it, you know, it might have been, I mean, I guess it could have been another area of the precept, you know, it could have been, you know, it could have been any sort of taken and not given, or any kind of, well, I don't know, any of the sort of, any of the sort of other precepts, it would have been equally applying if one was habitually doing that. It's almost that kind of feeling of thinking you can get, almost telling yourself you can get away with it, that this won't affect my mind. So I think the truth is you realise, whatever you're doing, even if no one knows, you're thinking, oh yeah, I'm getting away with this, nobody knows. It actually is affecting your own mind. So when you sit to meditate, one's conscience is troubled. So in a way, you're sharpening the sense of conscience, which is positive. It might not feel pleasant because it exposes yourself to yourself. But meditation will result in your ethical sensibility getting stronger. As a matter of fact, I can tell you something that happened the other way around. This might make more sense of it. It happened the other way around as well. And the very, very first time I ever did the Metta Bhavana, on the spot, I realised I'd be a vegetarian from then on. That was instant. It wasn't even any effort. As soon as I did the Metta Bhavana, I thought, that's it. Really, I thought, I'm not eating meat. I thought, how could I like chew a bit of flesh again in my entire life? That became impossible to me to do. So that was it, the other way around, if you see what I mean. The meditation had sharpened my ethical sense, and I just never ate meat again from that point on. So there's a sort of corresponding relationship. Yeah?
Consciousness without making conscious.
Exactly. Conscious, yeah.
Consciousness
making conscious.
Yeah, conscious. Conscious.
Exactly. So conscience and consciousness apparently are from the same root. Yeah? Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's exactly it. It's consciousness meeting conscience, or vice versa. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes?
The fascinating one we've seen earlier, seems to suggest it was about grasping and pushing away based on the conditioned reaction.
Yeah.
But you still guard out a little or push it away if you're conscious of the process.
Yes, well then I wouldn't call it grasping. So you can definitely make a conscious choice. But that's different from a sort of knee-jerk or grasping. So you can choose to, you know, take yourself out of a difficult situation. You can choose to, you know, you can choose if, I don't know, you can choose to, you know, I can choose to pick up that Dharma book and study it. So that, so you can make a conscious choice that's not reactive mind.
Yes, I'm glad to say that because for many years coming here, I kept moving the next apartment and I keep putting myself into the same situation. Given the situation, the people, and then it's almost like white my but there was something missing, and I felt calm in a way. And but something you said about that just then, which made more sense, which is consciously you take yourself out of that situation. But that's not like then spite you pushing something away.
No.
Thinking,
yeah.
And that goes into just something you just said there about consciousness saying, no, I'm just not really
meeting
them. It's not like aggressively saying to yourself, well, you know, something you're just unconscious that you shouldn't do.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's easier to walk away from some situation with love.
Yeah. So that's good, isn't it? So that's another, you know, when I was saying the different things about reactive mind and creative mind. So reactive mind is the sort of knee-jerk reaction of mind. Creative mind is positive choice. Yeah. So I want to take us a few more stages on this spiral path. So where I want to, so we've got this, we've got samadhi, which is meditation proper, the seventh link. Remember, these aren't literal links, but this is just to help us. Now the eighth stage is here, actually. The eighth stage is here. It's called knowledge and vision of things as they really are. So that's a very long title, and it's the crucial stage. It's a crucial stage, and it's crucial because this is the stage of insight, yeah, with a capital I. It's the stage of wisdom with a capital W. We've conquered the habits, yeah? And so why it's crucial, well, does anybody know why that's particularly important, this stage of conquering the habits? Maybe conquering will give you a clue. What's that?
You won't slip back into them.
Yes, you won't slip back into them. That's exactly right. So basically at this stage, basically the only way now is up the spiral, yeah? Up until there, even, you know, even at samadhi, even at bliss, rapture, all the rest of it, as soon as conditions change, you just can fall right back down, yeah, into your habits. And this we know well, don't we? You know, you've been on retreat, you feel like great, you feel really positive, creative, but then, I don't know, you don't meditate for a few days, and before you know it, you find yourself really annoyed with something, you're right back down here, yeah? But at this stage, you never, ever again go any way down the spiral. So you never ever again. So it's absolutely crucial. It's you don't slip back, you don't fall back. A later school of Buddhism called the Yogacara said it's the turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness, which I really love. Something's completely turned about, and you've seen through the habits. That's why you've conquered them. That's why it's called knowledge and vision. It's not just knowledge in an intellectual sense. It's something is deeply seen, and it's seen so deeply, you're just never going to go back. You know, you've seen the pain that's caused to yourself and others by acting in those old habitual ways. You've seen it so clearly, there's no possibility of ever going back. Yeah. So it's not enlightenment yet. There's still sort of work to be done, as it were. But how I think of it, the best way I can think of it is that there's still effort, but you want to make the effort, yeah? The effort becomes easier. I hope that isn't a contradiction in terms that you want to make it, and it feels like you're being sort of helped along, as it were. It's almost like you're making the effort, but you feel that you're being drawn on. Yeah, you feel that you're being drawn on more and more. So that's an absolutely crucial stage on the spiral path, this eighth stage. Bhante Sangharaksha's famously said that this is perfectly possible for every serious practitioner in their lifetime. So that's great, isn't it? That's great to know that there is that possibility for us if we keep practicing. Obviously, it won't come automatically, but if you keep practicing, there's that eighth stage.
Would you call that the realization?
You could certainly, I think the thing words like realization is quite a good description of it. There's definitely includes realization, which means again not just something with your brain in a way, but something very, very deep within you. There's a deep realization. Something is, I think, I like that word, something's conquered, something's completely overcome. Okay, so that's the eighth stage. There's 12 of these stages, by the way, the 12th being enlightenment. So that's the eighth stage. The ninth stage is called withdrawal. But it's not withdrawal in a negative sense, it's a sort of positive and natural withdrawal from anything that might hold you back. It's as natural as sometimes the way I think of it is, like, you know, when you're walking along the street and you think you've seen a £5 note or a £10 note lying there, and you think, oh. But then you realise it's only an old bit of paper. You're just not interested in it because it's not valuable, yeah? So it's that kind of withdrawal. You're not interested in acting in those old ways anymore. Or a bit like if you were in a desert, not that I ever have been, and you saw a mirage, and you were rushing to, but then you realise it's just a mirage. So it's just, it holds nothing for you. So those old ways of being, acting from greed and hatred, they're so unattractive that it's just completely natural to just know why would you engage with them, you know? So it's just a natural withdrawal. After that, the next stage, again, it's traditionally called dispassion, but again, this isn't a cold or hard thing. It's actually completely full-blooded. But it's a sort of being imperturbable. It's like a sitting loose to life. Nothing's going to disturb you. Nothing's going to knock you off center. You're just steady. You're completely engaged. Completely kind of wholehearted, but not knocked about. Usually unenlightened, we're just swayed around by the sort of worldly winds, as it's called. We're blown about by, do people like me, don't they like me? Imagine that, you just walk into a room or walk into a situation, you're just like you're not kind of thinking, oh, you know, do they like me, don't they? You're just completely happy to be you. Somebody talks to you, that's great. If they don't talk to you, that's great, you know, you're not blown about. So it's called dispassion, but it certainly doesn't mean anything cold or hard. That's the 10th. And then the 11th is freedom, that we're going to find more about. And then the 12th is enlightenment, but it's called knowledge and destruction of the ashravas, which means the poisons. So you could gloss this as you're not just free, but you know that you're free. You're not just free, but you know that you're free. And that's enlightenment. And as I was saying, enlightenment isn't an end point, yeah? And I think that's why that image of that spiral is brilliant, because it just keeps going sort of up and up and out and out. So it's not an end point. There's more and more unfoldment that can happen after enlightenment. At the same time, it is an end to something. So, it's an end to bondage because it's freedom. It's certainly an end of greed, hatred, and delusion. So never, ever, ever again, once you're enlightened, will you act out of hatred, will you act out of greed, or will there be any sense, will there be no pride at all, in the negative sense of pride, there'll be no delusion. So there's an end of something, yeah? So it's definitely decisive. So this point of knowledge and vision and this point of enlightenment are decisive points, and they're the end of something, but they're not end points. Do you see what I mean? Yeah? Do you see the difference between the end of something but not end points? Because that's nod if you do or shake if you don't, because that's important, yeah? Just to finish, so that's a classic tour through the 12 links of the spiral path. Yeah, that's so what I've taught you tonight is absolutely core classic Buddhism. Also, what's core and classic about this is the spiral path, which is the Dharma life, is natural. So in a certain sense, Bhante says, in a sense, it's good to learn these stages, but in another sense, you don't need to worry about them too much. You just need to cultivate the stage you're on, and it will overflow naturally, overspill, if you like, into the next stage. Yeah? So you just cultivate the one you're on, and then it will spill out into the next one. And this isn't just an idea, this isn't just a bright idea, it's an actual principle. So when anything happens, anything at all in life, whether it's a small thing like feeling a bit bored on a tube journey, or a major thing in your life, you can ask yourself, am I reacting cyclically or responding creatively? And Bhante says, he says a beautiful thing about that. He said, if there's a progressive response, however faint, however feeble, then at that very moment we place our foot, however hesitantly, upon the first step of the path to enlightenment. Yeah, so that's lovely, isn't it? Because it shows we can literally start this right now, yeah? We can literally start this spiral path right now and just allow it to unfold. So I hope that's whetted your appetite for more in this series. I do encourage you to buy a copy of the lecture. It's £5, and it's great actually. It's such a classic. It's such a classic of Bhante Sangharakshita's. I gave away back in the early 70s, This Taste of Freedom. So that's great background reading for what we're going to unfold over the next 6 weeks. Maybe that's all I'll say for this evening. So yeah, hopefully see you next week, where Surya is going to talk to us about an image for freedom. And then the week after, Padma Vajra, very, very senior visiting teacher, is going to talk to us more about this 11th stage on the spiral path, what freedom really is, and then keep going after that. Okay, so Thank you.
Thank you.